T-minus 10, 9, ignition sequence start.
Coming to you from a small undisclosed outpost somewhere in Radio Land, it's Because I Said So. Parenting advice with love and leadership from the nation's leading parenting expert, syndicated columnist, author, conference speaker, and the only psychologist to point out that psychology has caused more problems than it has solved for American parents, John Rosemond.
People like this are a menace to decent society.
Call in now about anything from toddlers to teens, even your 20-something toddlers who refuse to stop sucking on the pacifier of your standard of living.
Let's not talk about it in front of the boy.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
From American Family Radio Network, here's your host, John Rosemond.
Well, welcome to the show. John Rosemond here. The show is called Because I Said So. We're going to just jump right into things. But if you'd like to call us, the number is 404-419-6499. You can email us at radio@rosemond.com. And if you want to obtain more information about my ministry, you can go to Rosemond or johnrosemond.com. In last week's show, I was talking about the fact that everything bad about American parenting today had its start in the 1960s. Today's parents don't realize they are the inheritors of a parenting paradigm that was cobbled together by the mental health community in the 1960s, and a paradigm that has been extremely destructive to children, to parents, to marriages, to families, and by extension, to America. So I did get an email from a fellow who, obviously intent upon lowering my self-esteem, speculated that I either have yet to emerge from the Stone Age or just crawled out of the bomb shelter my parents stuffed me into in 1959. He refers specifically to my contention, which I made last week, that children should not be allowed to express their feelings freely. This was one of the parenting mantras that came out of the 60s. Children should be allowed to express their feelings freely. And I have said many times, no, people who express their feelings freely are behaving antisocially. These people are obnoxious. The proper training of a child trains the child to control his feeling expression. Anyway, this fellow sarcastically asks, like love, maybe? Well, since he mentioned it, yes, children should not even be allowed to express feelings of love freely. The problem with this fellow's thinking is the problem in contemporary American parenting. He implies that children should be allowed what adults are not allowed. In so doing, he inadvertently nails the problem. That very child-centered philosophy is the prime reason for the general degradation of parental discipline and therefore child behavior since the 1950s. Once upon a time, when a child of even toddler stage did something rude or antisocial, he or she was told in no uncertain terms to stop, to be quiet, to apologize, to give it back, leave the area, or whatever was appropriate to the situation. Silly attempts to reason, as in, you're making bad choices, Billy, were not a feature of the Stone Age parents' vocabulary. And in this way, children learned early on to control the expression of certain behaviors and feelings in certain situations. And that is how, by the way, a child is socialized. And it is in a child's best interest to be sensitized to social norms as early as possible. Take love, since the fellow raised the issue, for example. If it is inappropriate for an adult to simply blurt out, "I love you," whenever the feeling strikes, then I submit it is inappropriate for a child of certain age and in certain situations to do so as well. In both cases, the spontaneous expression of feeling, in this case, love, may cause the individual who is the object of said emotion to feel very uncomfortable. Let's use some common sense, also known as a Stone Age trait, at this point. It is cute for a 3-year-old boy to blurt this out to a female playmate. It is not necessarily cute when an 8-year-old boy does the same thing. Somewhere between the two ages, 3 and 8, the child needs to be told that expressing spontaneous love to someone outside of one's immediate family is to be done only after great forethought and always with prudence, another Stone Age virtue. Besides, in today's hyper-paranoid school system, expressing love toward a classmate may result in reassignment to a third-grade re-education camp somewhere in the Mojave Desert. The same applies to the expression of any emotion. The lack of emotional self-control is uncivilized, again, antisocial. The exercise of emotional self-control is civilized, pro-social. Therefore, I am arguing for nothing more radical than the restoration of civility to the training of children. What a remarkably, stunningly radical idea. The other day, I was in an airport waiting area, and a mother was following her toddler as he ran up and down the rows of occupied seats, yelling incoherently, causing a general disturbance. Mom was following this child, smiling all the while, as if she thought that was cute. No doubt she would agree with my critic. Her child wants to run and yell in a public place. Therefore, he should be allowed. Now, this is new parenting, folks. This is the result of the professional parenting propaganda that came out of the 1960s, to wit, children should be allowed to freely express their feelings. If they're not allowed to do so, psychological scarring will develop, and so on and so forth. So this mother believes that since her child wants to run and yell in a public place, he should be allowed to run and yell, and she should run grinning after him, doubling the disturbance to the people who are seated in the gate area of this particular airport, reading, holding quiet conversation, thinking, sleeping, whatever it is they're doing. I am certain that the Stone Age mother would have removed her child from the area very, very quickly, insisted that he calm down, and taught him to sit quietly with her in public situations. And everyone, including her child, would have benefited from this Stone Age mother's repressive, draconian attitude toward her responsibilities as a parent. This is John Roseman, your host. The show is called Because I Said So, and it's called Because I Said So, Because I Said So. If you want to call us, the phone number is 404-419-6499. Email us at radio@roseman.com. Or if you would rather tweet, it's at John K. Roseman. We will be back in a moment with more of this parenting heresy. Stay with us. Welcome back to the show. Your host, John Rosemond. Our call-in number, if you'd like to join the show with a question or comment, is 404-419-6499. 404-419-6499. And we do have a caller on the line. I'm going to postpone taking the call for a minute or two because I want to tell a story. The place was a church in South Carolina. Saturday morning, I'm about to do a three-hour seminar on effective discipline, and a woman walks up to me in the lobby, which is where I hang out, meeting and greeting before a talk, and she told me that she had a five-year-old who wouldn't do anything she told her to do. And I said, I'm not going to get into an argument with you, and I don't mean to, but I have to tell you that that isn't true. And she looked at me with this semi-startled expression. She said, what do you mean it's not true? I said, well, you don't have a five-year-old who won't do what she's told. She said, yes, I do, John. I said, no, ma'am, here's a fact. This is a fact that's not a theory. Children do what they're told 80% of the time, and that is worst possible scenario. Worst possible scenario. Now, 80% of the time for a five-year-old, because a five-year-old is still in training. And this is what a child's training is all about, is accepting authority and doing what people who are in positions of legitimate authority tell you to do. 80% of the time, children do what they're told. She said, well, John, then my child defies the statistic because my child won't do what I tell her to do ever about anything. And I said, no. Your child does not defy the statistic. The problem is not your child. I'm going to venture, and I don't mean this to be insulting, that the problem is you. She said, how so? I said, because you're doing what I venture to propose. You're doing what 99% of today's parents do. They think they're telling. They're not. They're pleading, bargaining, bribing, cajoling, reasoning, explaining, encouraging, and promising. And when none of that works, then they threaten, then they get red in the face, then they scream, then they feel bad, then they purge their guilt by doing something special for children who have just disobeyed, and then they go right back to pleading, bargaining, bribing, cajoling, reasoning, explaining, encouraging, promising, threatening, getting red in the face, and so on and so forth. And around you go, and you will stop this merry-go-round when you learn how to tell your daughter what you want her to do. So, with that introduction, Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, did the story relate to you at all?
Sadly, very much so.
Well, tell me what your question is.
In general, do you have a rule of thumb when it comes to first-time obedience? And I mean, I have a couple stories if you need them, but just like a general guideline of what we could go off of to get that first-time obedience. And
okay.
That's training, of course.
Okay. All right. Great. Great question. And it's a perfect fit with the story I told at the beginning of this segment. How old are your children, Carrie?
I have a 6-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 7-month-old, and all boys.
All boys, and they do not obey when you, do you tell, or do you plead, bargain, bribe, cajole, reason, explain, encourage, and promise?
My husband and I do not bribe, but I think I tell and then maybe plead and bargain and all the other stuff. So I'm not sure. What do you mean by tell?
Well, let me give you an example. Here's telling a child to pick up his toys. I want you to pick up your toys. I want them all picked up right now and moved to another room. I'll be back in a few minutes to see that it's done. And you turn around and you walk away. Now, here's telling on the part of a parent in the year 2015, honey, mommy's girlfriend is coming over and I'd like to serve her coffee and pastries in this room. And it would really be helpful to me if you would pick up these toys and move them somewhere else. Will you do that for mommy, okay?
I'm the latter of what you just said.
You are the latter. Okay.
Yes.
And this is, and don't feel bad about it, Carrie, because the latter description applies to 99, and that may be a conservative figure, of 99% of today's parents. And what people don't realize, what parents today don't realize, is that obedience is a response to the proper presentation of authority on the part of the parent. I'm going to say that again. Obedience on the part of a child is a response to the proper presentation of authority on the part of the child. It is my observation, and it is confirmed by the overwhelming majority of parents, that today's parents do not properly present authority to their children. Again, instead of telling their children what they want them to do, using the fewest words possible, using no explanation whatsoever, they instead engage in explanation, pleading, bargaining, bribing, reasoning, cajoling, so on and so on and so forth. And what they get is a response from the child that is predicted on the basis of that sort of approach. When you do not properly present authority in your body language, in your tone of voice, in the use of an economy of language, and so on and so forth, you are not going to get the response that you want to get. When you properly present authority, honey, I want these toys picked up, all of them right now, move somewhere else. I'll be back in a few minutes to see that it's done. You are far more likely to get first-time obedience. I was at a conference in South Carolina on Kiowa Island a couple of summers ago, and I was speaking over a three-day period of time, and I talked about this proper presentation of authority, which I call leadership speech or alpha speech. I talked about it on day one. And I made it clear that it's not only the words you use, it's your entire presentation. It's your body language. It's your facial expression. It's your tone of voice. It is not, for example, bending over, scrunching down, getting down to your child's level, grabbing your knees, that sort of thing that so many parents today do because they've read that this is the way that they should do it and some evil publication like Parents Magazine. And on the second day, after I talked about that on the first day, on the second day of the conference, probably more than a dozen people came up to me and said, John, it is already working. This is amazing. Exactly, because a child's natural response to the proper presentation of authority on the part of a parent, and I will again say it, a child's natural response to the proper presentation of authority on the part of a parent is obedience. Another story, a couple of years ago in a seminar, I looked at a guy, he was 75 years old, he was simply there as an observer, he's a grandfather. I turned to him and I said, Don was his name. Don, were you an obedient child? And this is out of the blue. We had not practiced this. Don, were you an obedient child? He said, yeah, I was obedient. He said, I was occasionally mischievous. I tried to get away with things when my parents weren't looking, but they gave me an instruction. I obeyed. I said, well, what methods, techniques, and strategies did they use to get you to obey? And he said, there were no methods, there were no techniques or strategies. The expectation was just perfectly clear. And what he was referring to, Carrie, is exactly what I am talking about, the proper presentation of authority, leadership speech, alpha speech. With the proper presentation of authority, you stand fully upright, you use an economy of words, you do not give explanations because explanations stimulate argument. The minute you tell the child why you want him to pick up the toys, he begins to argue with you about whether or not he should really have to based on your explanation.
100% true.
Okay. And so you don't use explanation. You don't explain yourself, which forces a child, by the way, and this is why people in my generation, I'm 67 years old, people in my generation, every single one of us will tell you we heard because I said so on a fairly regular basis. Why did we hear because I said so? Because our parents did not explain their instructions to us. And when you don't explain your instruction to a child, it causes the child to ask either why or why not, at which point the authoritative answer is because I said so, or because that is the decision I have made, or because I have just told you to do it. And then you turn around and walk away. Another part of this authoritative presentation is you do not engage the child in conversation about the instruction that you have just given, because that conversation, again, is going to lead invariably to an argument. And so you turn around and walk away. And I call this pulling the plug on the power struggle. So let me put it all together for you. First of all, you don't do what professionals tell you to do, which is bend over and get down to your child's level. You present yourself in a fully upright position. That's number one. Number two, you use an economy of words. Before you go into an instructional situation, ask yourself, what are the fewest words I can use to convey this instruction? Number three, you give no explanation. Number four, you turn around and walk away. Carrie, I guarantee you, I guarantee it, if you adopt this approach, you will begin to experience first-time obedience. It's not about consequences, although consequences are sometimes necessary. You should not rely upon them. You should rely on this authoritative leadership speech presentation that I'm talking about. Folks, we're at the end of this segment. Carrie, thank you for a great question. My name is John Rosemond. If you want to call us, the phone number is 404-419-6499. Email us at radio@rosemond.com. Or if you would rather tweet, it's @JohnKRosemond. And stay with us, folks. We'll be right back.
T-10, 9, ignition sequence starts.
Coming to you from a small undisclosed outpost somewhere in Radioland, it's Because I Said So. Parenting advice with love and leadership from the nation's leading parenting expert, syndicated columnist, author, conference speaker, and the only psychologist to point out that psychology has caused more problems than it has solved for American parents. John Rosemond.
People like this are a menace to decent society.
Call in now about anything from toddlers to teens, even your 20-something toddlers who refuse to stop sucking on the pacifier of your standard of living.
Let's not talk about it in front of the boy.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
From American Family Radio Network, here's your host, John Rosemond.
Well, welcome to the show. John Rosemond here, and the show is called Because I Said So, brought to you by Creative Genius Productions and American Family Radio. My thanks to both of them. One of my repetitive, if you will, themes on this program, and you heard a hint of it in the program intro, is that I am a psychologist. I'm licensed by the North Carolina Psychology Board. The term psychologist is a legislated term, meaning that one cannot use it legally unless it has been conferred upon the one in question by a duly recognized state licensing board, which is the case with me. I do believe that, and I have reason to believe, and I, in fact, am very confident when I say that my licensing board regrets the day they ever gave me a license, because I go around the country and I tell people what I absolutely know to be the truth and what can be supported statistically, and that is that psychology has caused more problems for the American family than psychologists even know how to solve. And I know that because I'm a psychologist. I can tell you that with a great degree of confidence because I have seen the profession from the inside since 1979 when my license was granted to me. I really didn't realize this initially because the Lord had not, and he still hasn't, but he certainly had not finished leading me in the direction that he wanted to lead me by 1979. But it wasn't long thereafter that I began to realize that the 1960s, the decade during which I came of age, I was 13 when the 1960s began, I was 23, married with one child and another on the way when the 1960s ended. And I was beginning to realize that the 1960s had been an extremely destructive decade in America, for America. We entered the 1960s, one America. We exited the 1960s, a completely different America. We became, during the 1960s, a postmodern progressive nation. Because of postmodernity, we began to embrace relativism, the insidious idea that there are no standards of right and wrong, and now we have no standards, according to the secular world anyway, no standards concerning gender. You can be any gender you want to be. It doesn't matter whether God has assigned you to the gender male. You can be female if you want to be. And the other aspect of the 1960s was progressivism, the idea that new ideas are better than old ideas. Prior to the 1960s, pretty much, I would say most people in America would have agreed that there was nothing new under the sun. And after the 1960s, people embraced the idea that new ideas are better than old ideas. Everything bad about parenting in America today had its beginnings in the 1960s. Before the 1960s, people, when they needed advice concerning the rearing of a child, they went to an elder in their extended family, generally speaking. They went to their child's grandmother, grandfather. They went to a great aunt. They went to an older sibling who had raised or was raising older children and had more experience and wisdom in the parenting realm. If a person of that sort was not immediately available in one's extended family, then one sought out an elder in one's church or neighborhood. And I call these elders, I just give them the generic label grandma. The parents sat down with grandma in her living room or her kitchen over two cups of coffee, two glasses of iced tea, and began talking to grandma. And grandma gave advice that was based on a life she had led, not books she had read. And she didn't charge for this advice. She wasn't watching a clock. And when she talked, she was not talking in theoretical terms. When she gave advice, she came straight to the point. And one of the things that grandma accomplished that I'm absolutely convinced that psychologists and other mental health professionals rarely accomplish is grandma was able to convince this young, maybe slightly confused parent who'd been knocked off balance by a problem her child had thrown at her, that she was capable, being a responsible adult, she was capable of dealing with whatever the problem was successfully. And one of the things that happened during the 1960s is we began to turn to professionals for advice concerning the rearing of children. Benjamin Spock really didn't have anything to do with what I call the psychological parenting revolution that took place in the late 60s and early 1970s. It was actually kicked off by the publication of a book by a Manhattan psychologist named Chaim Gnat. And the title of the book was Between Parent and Child. And Gnat's radical proposition was that a child's emotional expressions were, in some odd way, a valid, reliable indicator of the quality of the parenting that the child was receiving, and that one of the requirements of good parenting was to properly understand, interpret, and respond to your child's emotional expressions. And therefore, today, as a consequence of this, people began to believe, and the mental health community began to promote the belief, that children had a right to freely express emotion. Now, this has become a cancer in American parenting. It was unheard of in the 1950s, for example, for a child 5 years old to be seen throwing a tantrum in a public place. Today, this sort of behavior on the part of 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 7-year-old, 8-year-old children screaming their displeasure at something in public places is ubiquitous. And this is where it had its start. It had its start in the 1960s, and it had its start because of insidious, destructive, professional propaganda. The show is Because I Said So. I'm your host, John Rosemond. If you want to email us, you can do so at radio@Rosemond, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D.com. If you want to call us, and we welcome your calls, the number is 404-419-6499, 404-419-6499. Back in a minute with more on the subject of parenting. Why? Because I said so. Welcome back to the show. This is your host, John Rosemond. The show is called Because I Said So. If you want to join us, our phone number is 404-419-6499. If you'd rather send us an email, it's radio@Rosemond, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D.com. For more information about me, my books, my speaking schedule, and so on and so forth, you can go to johnrosemond.com. We do have a caller waiting on the line. Her name is Patricia, and she is from San Diego, California. Patricia, how can I help you?
I've been listening to your show on American Family Radio, and I heard a long interview with you by one of the someone before your show started on American Family Radio, and I heard about your book, Parenting by the Book, and I just thought, wow, I waited all my life to hear from this man and this book to come out, and immediately thought, well, I want to send this to all my grown children to help them with my grandchildren. I was just smitten by it.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Thank you, Patricia. I really appreciate those sentiments.
It was more than sentiments. I could tell that there was something really going on in the way of a mission that God had given you out there that's so needful. I'd been raising horses for probably about 40 years for rodeo competition. And I recently had met a family in my neighborhood who just moved in that had a young girl, 16. She was a sophomore in high school. And the family and I had talked about the possibility of her working with me and helping with the horses. And at first, it just seemed like an answer to something I'd prayed for many years because my children were grown up and gone, and I didn't have riders for the horses. And but after a while, I saw some things about this young girl's personality that were pretty shocking, but I was already becoming attached to her. And I began to wonder if this was an opportunity to witness to her family and to her, or if I was just getting in way over my head and God had allowed me to see all these things about this young girl early on. I've had an opportunity over the last 40 years to really bring some of God's grace into people's lives and become connected because of raising horses in just amazing, amazing ways. So you just don't know. And so I thought I would call up and talk to you. And, of course, I had a question about could I dare to talk to her parents.
Be more specific. Tell me exactly what it is. What were these behaviors? Because in the first place, it sounds like you've got experience witnessing to people. You've got some experience in this area. You're just insecure about whether in this particular situation you should be saying anything to this young girl's parents. So give me some specifics. What is it that has caused you such concern?
Well, when I first was around her, she just said she would just do anything. She would give her life to work with these horses, and she just seemed so eager, and she showed me videos of herself rodeoing, and she already is a champion. But then when I was alone with her, with the animals, I saw that she was very rough with them. She wouldn't listen to me. She had a very forward personality. She almost changed personalities completely. And she wanted to work free for the right to ride them and compete in rodeos. And I didn't want to make a commitment because of some of the things I was seeing. She picked up a young man after school and then picked me up. And when I said, let's stop by and show him your mother's new ranch, she said, oh, well, he's not allowed. So she was sneaking behind her mother's back with this young man. And while he was in the back seat of the car, she ran a red light on purpose to show off for him.
All right. Let me stop you right here, Patricia. Let me get some more information in order to help provide you with some hopefully helpful guidance. Is this a Christian family?
No.
Okay. Well, that certainly mitigates against you being able to approach these parents on I'll call it a level playing field.
Right.
You don't have with them a shared worldview.
No, absolutely not.
Right. And it is unlikely under these circumstances, and I'm responding to this based largely on my experience in this area. It is unlikely if you approach them and your intent is to be helpful, and you approach them with a Christian heart,
yes.
It is unlikely under the circumstances that, well, let me put it this way, there is strong likelihood that they will not see what you are doing as helpful.
Right.
There is strong likelihood that they will respond defensively. Let's face it, this girl has some upbringing issues.
Yes.
Okay. And if you tell her parents, in effect, without using these terms, of course, or this term, your daughter's got some upbringing issues. There is strong likelihood, because these are not Christian parents, they do not share your worldview, they will not perceive this as helpful, that they are going to respond defensively, angrily. And if you are ready to accept that, and you are ready to absorb the consequences of that, whatever they may be, primarily their anger, their potential anger at you for whatever they perceive this to be, criticizing their parenting, criticizing their darling daughter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then go ahead. But don't jump into this without a clear understanding of what feathers you are very likely to ruffle here.
Yeah. Well, I just didn't want to miss an opportunity to witness them and pray for them. I came out of a background like that. I know that Christ can do wondrous things, but I don't want to point myself to adopt this young girl and put myself in a situation where I'm in over my head. I have been praying for a young girl whose mother would be eager for her to rodeo, and this young girl's brother is a champion. He's out on the road now doing it. He's a few years older than her. I see her as an at-risk child because she almost manifests two completely different personalities.
From what you're describing, she's got some under-socialized, psychologists would call it, tendencies. She's got some antisocial tendencies, and the real red flag here is that even in your presence, she has been less than caring in her approach and behavior toward the horses. And you can imagine, you can extrapolate from that, and I think legitimately conclude that there is a high possibility that if you were not there providing guidance to her when she was with the horses, that she might be downright abusive. And
she was very abusive, and her mother said she didn't know anything about. All she knew was how to get up on a champion and ride fast and win.
So she was abusive even with you there. And that that seals the deal, so to speak.
Yeah.
This is a child who's got serious, at the age of 16, antisocial tendencies. Cruelty to animals is a huge, if not the biggest, red flag there is concerning narcissistic personality disorder, and is what psychologists call it.
I've been studying narcissistic personality disorder and recently for other reasons, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that and the word red flag, because there was no compassion for the animals at all. They're objects that she's going to get up on and look good and win more trophies, and she does have a lot of trophies.
Right. It's all about her. It's all about
it's
her
all about
performance.
Her. Yeah.
And if the horses do not completely cooperate with her, then she is justified, because this is the premise of the narcissist. What I want, I deserve to have. And because I deserve it, the ends justify the means. These are very, very dangerous people. In effect, and I've said this before on the show, these people have never outgrown toddlerhood. That is a toddler personality trait. Every parent who has been around a toddler has seen this express itself in various ways. The toddler narcissistic personality disorder, what I want, I deserve to have, and because I deserve it, the ends justify the means. What we're seeing in America today, Patricia, and this girl is a prime example, is many, many children who have never been disciplined properly and therefore have never fully outgrown the personality disorder that is inherent to toddlerhood. Toddlers are dangerous little people. This is why God in his mercy and grace has distinguished us from the animals in one very significant way. And that is, he keeps human beings, and only human beings, small for a long period of time. He does not, as he does with the animals, allow us to grow to full size in 1 or 2 years. Patricia, my advice to you would be, do not approach these parents. You do not share the same worldview. There is strong likelihood they're not going to appreciate what you do. I would sever my relationship with this girl and her family as quickly as possible. I think that's going to be in your best interest as well. This is John Roseman. The show is Because I Said So. 404-419-6499 or radio@roseman.com if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment. Be back in a minute.
American Family Radio Network, it's Because I Said So. Now, once again, here's your host, John Rosemond.
Welcome back to the show. Thanks for staying with us. We've reached that point in the program where I do our much anticipated You've Got to Be Kidding Me segment. And today's You've Got to Be Kidding Me involves a school district in Ohio. Ohio, great place, by the way. Love Ohio. It's irrelevant where this actually took place because this is the kind of thing that is happening all over America in America's public schools. You rarely hear of this sort of thing happening in a private school, Christian school environment. It's not that the incident in question does not happen in those environments. It's just that when incidents of the sort in question happen in private school, independent school, Christian school, parochial school environments, people seem better capable of keeping their heads about the whole thing. Anyway, in this school system in Ohio, a second grader was expelled from school for the rest of the year. The incident in question took place in May, granted, early May, so there was only a month left. But think of you know, being in the second grade and being expelled from school, and you're an otherwise good kid, okay? Think of the impact that is going to have on this child's self-concept for quite some time to come. She was expelled from school for the rest of the year for bringing a toy cap gun onto a school bus. The child was given the option of returning to school sooner, in other words, only being expelled maybe a week or so, if the family agreed to have her evaluated by a psychologist or a psychiatrist at their cost, and then provide the professional's report to the school district. The girl's parents refused, saying school officials had overreacted. Oh, good for you, Mom. Just good for you. I wish I could identify you by name on the air. All I can say is, and I hope you're listening or hear this program someday, good for you. She's only 7 years old, the mother was quoted as saying. To my daughter, it was only a toy. She didn't wave it around. She didn't point it at anyone. She didn't make any threats. Indeed, that seems to be the case. Everybody agrees on that. According to published reports, which the school system has not denied, the girl showed the cap gun to another student. Other children saw it and began screaming, yelling, and hiding under their seats. You know, this is the kind of reaction that today's children have been trained in by hyper-paranoid adults. The bus driver stopped the bus and confiscated the gun. A person who reads my column sent me the story, noting that if she, the reader, had brought her cap pistol to school. I mean, you know, everybody my age, girl and boy, we all had cap pistols. The boys had Hopalong Cassidy or Lone Ranger cap pistols, sometimes Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and the girls had Dale Evans cap pistols. That was Roy Rogers' wife, by the way. If she, the reader who sent me the story, had brought her cap pistol to school, it would simply have been taken away just as any other distracting toy would have been. Agreed. The only person who seems to have kept her wits about her in this situation is the child's parents, the child's mother, whose stonewalled efforts to mark her child with some bogus psychological disorder. Again, mom in Ohio of 7-year-old girl who is in no danger of becoming a future mass murderer. Good for you. And now we've got a caller on the line. His name is Michael, and Michael, ironically, is from Ohio. Michael, welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Well, I got a comment. I listened to your program the other evening, and there was an individual on there that had like a 15-year-old boy, if memory serves me right, that was very excelling in school. He did very well in school. He did not come from a broken home. Everybody loved him, and he had a magnetic personality. But when he got home, it's just like, you know, the total opposite. You know, I mean, verbal abuse, wouldn't do anything, and so forth. And so I'm calling in with a comment. You know, they didn't really know what to do. Apparently, they said, well, we'll put things on the refrigerator, and you know, if you get like 5 marks, then you don't go to band camp. My comment is, you know, we have a culture change. It's not bad parenting. Before World War II, 70% of the people lived in the rural areas. Okay, after the war, 70% of the people became urban dwellers.
And one aspect of that, Michael, is, pardon my interruption, but one very significant aspect of that is that because 70% of the American population prior to World War II, and I'm familiar with the statistic, lived in rural areas, every family, with rare exception, lived in the same area in which the parents had grown up, and so the grandparents were lived within proximity, the aunts and uncles, the entire extended family was there. And after World War II, the urbanization of America in part meant, and this is very significant to an understanding of how parenting has changed in that time, the urbanization of the American family in part meant that those extended family supports and accountability were no longer present in as many cases. And I think that's sort of where you were going. Am I correct?
Well, yeah, you're correct to a point. Basically, when they were on the farm, they matured at a much earlier age.
Agreed.
They accepted responsibilities, and they were grown up. Today, when in the urban areas, well, like for example, okay, if you take a Walton's, what would happen if John Boy wouldn't have split the wood? Well, they wouldn't have been warm in the winter. What would happen if they didn't milk the cow? The cow would dry up and they wouldn't have any milk. So everybody had a responsibility that was instilled within them with their parents and, like you said, the grandparents and uncles and so forth. And it really worked. They taught these people real world values, something that they can carry with them the rest of their life.
Children had responsibilities. Children had clear roles. Roles are defined in terms of responsibilities. Children were consumers, which all children are in their families, but children were also contributors within their families. They learned at a very early age that nothing is free. And today's children are on a never-ending entitlement program.
Well, I agree because I had asked a few teenage kids, I said, what do you actually contribute to your home with your mom and dad?
Oh, well, they're just there. That's all they are. They're there.
I make my bed and I take out the trash.
Maybe.
And I'm thinking, that's it? But anyways, what I'm saying is they are today maturing physically at a much younger age, but then they're developing emotionally and becoming an adult later. And this is where you have the boomerang generations of people. They're trying to find their own rite of passage. In the Jewish community, by the time they're 13, they teach the children all life skills up until the age of 13. At that point, they have a ceremony to celebrate them graduating from a child to an adult with adult consequences.
Right.
So they know at that point that they are a full-fledged adult. They can't be this what has been determined as adolescence, this crazy period of time.
Right. Well, I've talked to a lot of Jewish parents about this very issue, Michael, and they're really not. It may have been the case 2,000 years ago. Today, they are not actually considered fully fledged adults at the age of 13, having passed through the ritual of the bar bat mitzvah. They are considered apprentice adults. But the important thing is that there is a coming of age ritual. There is a celebration of the fact that the child in Jewish culture has been successfully discipled by the age of 13. One of the things I say is all the time around the country, you never hear of a Jewish kid street gang. You never hear of Jewish kids running in packs as delinquents. And
no.
I believe that this is significantly related to the fact that Jewish culture in America is the only culture in America that has held on to this coming of age ritual. You're absolutely correct.
Now there is another group of people, and we have a lot of them here in Ohio and Indiana and Pennsylvania.
Oh, the Amish. I forgot. Yes.
The Amish.
Yeah.
And because at the age of 16, they enter a period called Rumspringer. Basically, that translates into the time to run around.
Right.
Okay. But at that point, on Saturday afternoons and Sunday afternoons and evenings, they're allowed to go out into the world and socialize. And they've got 2 years or until they're married. But basically, the Rumspringer is basically an opportunity for them to socialize and to possibly find a mate. At that point, they have to make a decision whether to stay with the church or if they're going to depart from the church. But irregardless, they are considered an adult at that point.
Right. And let me interrupt you at this point. I don't know the actual statistic. Maybe living in an Amish area, you do. But it is true, is it not, that the overwhelming majority of Amish children, after this Rumspringer period in their lives, they do come back to the Amish community.
The stats on that is 9 out of 10.
Yes, 90% of those kids. And this is a testament in both Jewish culture and Amish culture of the success that is still possible concerning the discipling of the child at a relatively early age. Something that, one of the comments I make, I hear the same problems from parents in an evangelical church as I hear in a secular public school in the Northeast. Michael, thanks a lot for your call. This is John Roseman. The show is Because I Said So, and we'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, John Roseman. The program is called Because I Said So. It is a provocative and often fascinating commentary on the raising of children, which people today call parenting, a word I really don't like. In 2009, I published through Howard Books a book titled Parenting by the Book. I had brought Jesus Christ into my life 9 years before in the year 2000 as a result of reading Lee Strobel's The Case for Christ several times, and had felt called after Christ came into my life to write a book that would explicate biblical teachings concerning the rearing of children, because it became strikingly apparent to me after I brought Christ into my life that American parents, even in the Christian community, were by and large not adhering to biblical principle in the raising of kids, and that the reason so many American parents were experiencing such difficulty, such stress, such anxiety, et cetera, in the raising of kids was because we were depending on man's understandings concerning child rearing and had been since the mid-1960s, instead of trusting in the Lord with all of our hearts, Proverbs 3:5, or a paraphrase thereof. A lot of people, that is a book that lays out a principles-based approach to parenting. A lot of people, after I wrote the book, came up to me in public situations where I was doing talks and said that they would really have appreciated more specific methods-based advice when it comes to discipline. So with some reluctance, because here's the way I feel about this, I can teach you a disciplinary method, but it's not going to work, or at best, it will only work for a short period of time if you do not build this method or use this method, if you do not already have in place a solid principles-based parenting foundation. So it is having that foundation of biblical principle that causes just about any approach to discipline that you take to work. So I wrote the book, the follow-up to Parenting by the Book. It's called The Well-Behaved Child, Discipline That Really Works. I spend the first half of the book asking people, begging people, pleading with people not to read the second half where all the methods are laid out. But the Bible, what does the Bible say about discipline? Well, God says a number of things concerning discipline. First of all, why is it necessary to properly discipline a child? And the Bible is clear on this. It has to do with the innate, inherent sinfulness of children. Children do not have to be taught to misbehave. Misbehavior comes naturally to children. In any given situation, a young child is inclined, by virtue of the nature he or she brought with him into the world, the sinful nature that I referred to a moment ago, to do the wrong thing, not the right thing, to do the self-serving thing as opposed to the other-serving thing. The positive influence of significant adults who are committed to the goal of raising a person of character. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 and 7. God clearly says, this is his first direct instruction to parents. Look, what I want you to do is train your child's character. I tell people all over America, I hope they're not too disappointed, God does not really care about your child's grades. He doesn't care if your child gets a scholarship to Harvard, becomes a doctor, a famous neurosurgeon, whatever that may be. All God cares about is your child's character. He makes that very, very clear in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, where he says, and I'm going to paraphrase slightly because I didn't anticipate that I was going to go here, so I don't have it in front of me. He says, NIV version, impress these commandments upon your children. In the New King James and King James versions, it reads, teach these commandments diligently to your children. And then the paraphrase, at every possible opportunity, as you walk down the road, as you prepare for bed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the positive influence of significant adults who are committed to the goal of raising a child of character is essential if a child is going to make and keep making the choice to behave properly in any given situation in a manner that is both respectful to others and respectful to God, our Creator. Here are some of the biblical verses that support this idea. The Lord disciplines those he loves. As a father, the son he delights in. That's Proverbs 3:12. I'll read it again. The Lord disciplines those he loves. In other words, there is no contradiction between powerful, godly discipline of a child and the godly love of a child as well. As a father, the son he delights in. Here's another one. Those who spare the rod of discipline hate their children. Those who love their children care enough to discipline them. Notice it doesn't say care enough to spank them. It says care enough to discipline them. Now, this is a controversial thing, but let me go into this for a minute. The word rod is used in Scripture in two separate ways. In the first way, it is preceded by the article a. In the second, it is preceded by the article the. If you look at the use of the word rod across Scripture and apply the principle of biblical exegesis that Scripture interprets Scripture, it is clear that when the word rod is preceded by the article the, as opposed to the article a, it is being used metaphorically. It is not being used literally, as is the case when the word appears as a rod. Every single time the word rod is used in the context of the discipline of children, it is used with the metaphorical article the in front of it. Now, that does not eliminate the possibility of a spanking, but I keep saying to people all over the country, do you really think God wants us to spank our children every single time they misbehave? Do you understand how many spankings the young child would receive under those circumstances? So, those who spare the rod of discipline, what does the rod of discipline mean? It means godly discipline. It does not mean necessarily, although, as I said, it doesn't exclude it, a spanking. Those who spare the rod of discipline hate their children. Those who love their children care enough to discipline them. That's Proverbs 13:24. In the 1970s, I was the first parenting pundit to assert that a family should be operated as a benevolent dictatorship. That's the term I gave it. It was my intention to convey that proper parenting was constituted of equal measures of powerful love and powerful leadership, unconditional love, unequivocal leadership. The Latin root of benevolent means for the good of, and the root of dictator is dictate. So you put those two together, and what you've got is benevolent dictator, a person who instructs with loving authority for the best interest of the child. I felt the term captured the essence of good parenting. Rather quickly, however, I discovered that many people, especially professionals who taught and worked with children, only heard dictatorship and were appalled as a consequence. The resulting knee-jerk reaction was usually accompanied with lots of shouting and general boorishness, as my mother would have called it. In my vain attempts to defend and explain myself, I came to realize that these same people thought love was enough to raise a functional child. No matter what word I might have used to reflect the need on the part of a child for authoritative leadership, these romantic, very liberal idealists would have suffered convulsions. It's all well and good for someone to say he loves someone else. It's all well and good for a person to say he loves his child, but that profession of love is meaningless without affirming action. In the case of parental love, proper discipline is one such affirmation. The Bible says that discipline is an expression of delight in one's child. The more parents delight, the more effectively they discipline. And the more effectively they discipline, the more they will delight. The Bible also says that parents who discipline their children properly are doing the Lord's work. It should go without saying that more gratifying employment cannot be found. Well, this has been another episode of Because I Said So on American Family Radio, this provocative and hopefully fascinating look at American parenting. The show is produced by the inimitable Rich Rosel, and I'm John Roseman, psychologist, syndicated columnist, author, public speaker, and now radio talk show host. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us again next weekend at 5 o'clock Central Time right here. Why? Because I said so. From Creative Genius Productions and American Family Radio Network.
T-minus 10, 9, ignition sequence starts.
Coming to you from a small undisclosed outpost somewhere in Radioland, it's Because I Said So. Parenting advice with love and leadership from the nation's leading parenting expert, syndicated columnist, author, conference speaker, and the only psychologist to point out that psychology has caused more problems than it has solved for American parents. John Roseman.
People like this are a menace to decent society.
Call in now about anything from toddlers to teens, even your 20-something toddlers who refuse to stop sucking on the pacifier of your standard of living.
Let's not talk about it in front of the boy.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
From American Family Radio Network, here's your host, John Roseman.
Hi there, and welcome to Because I Said So. I'm John Roseman, your host. I'm a psychologist who doesn't believe in psychology. I have long maintained that mental health professionals, in effect, troll for clients by inventing disorders and then convincing people they have said disorders and need professional help. Take, for example, autism spectrum disorder, which is apparently defined as anything other than completely normal, which, of course, no child is. If I had grown up in these strange times, I would have had at least 3 diagnoses, including, I think, autism spectrum disorder by age 12. There's little doubt about it. Well, researchers at Duke University, that bastion of conservative objectivity, have discovered that picky eaters may also be depressed, suffer from ADHD, be socially anxious, and Lord knows what else. Who knew that believing you are entitled to special meals could be so complicated? The lead researcher, one Nancy Zucker, I believe that's the pronunciation, said that picky eaters tend to be more sensitive to taste, smell, texture, and even intense lighting. Ooh. Picky eaters, Zucker opined, and I'm quoting from her report, could have a potentially richer, more vivid life experience, but it could be a vulnerability if it crosses a threshold where it begins to impair them. She also said, now get this, when picky eaters have limited options at home, things could get very difficult and going out to eat becomes almost impossible. Now look, folks. What this means is that if you don't want things to be difficult, then cater to your picky eater. Oh, and don't go to a restaurant unless you're willing to let your little tyrant order a la carte from the menu. Well, here's a fact. And this is, it's a universal fact. If allowed, I would have been a picky eater. You would have been a picky eater. Any child is a potentially picky eater. The first time a child's taste buds experience a new food that isn't sugary sweet, meaning just about any new green vegetable, for example, the child's taste buds are likely to have a ooh, yuck reaction. I had an ooh, yuck reaction the first time I ate broccoli. I remember it quite clearly. We didn't have broccoli for some reason when I was in my early childhood. I think the first time I tasted it, I was about six. I told my parents I didn't like it and didn't want to eat it, and they told me in return I was going to sit at the table until I did. But why, I whined, because there are children starving in the world who would be grateful to eat what you say you don't want. One time I actually told my parents to box up whatever it was, Brussels sprouts maybe, and send it to the starving children because I certainly didn't want it. That didn't go over well. I never suggested that again. Today, broccoli and Brussels sprouts are two of my favorite foods. And they are two of my favorite foods in large part because my parents told me there were starving children in the world and I was going to sit at the table until I ate them. Nothing better in my estimation than broccoli drizzled with melted butter. Yes. As for this blah, blah, blah from Dr. Zucker about picky eaters actually having richer life experiences that sometimes tip over into what she calls vulnerabilities, that's all that is. It's blah, 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 the same old from mental health professionals that you get all the time. My second grandson, Patrick, when he was at our house for dinner one night, he was 4 years old, I fixed one of my favorite preparation, spaghetti bolognese, then a fresh salad. When I served him, Patrick told me in very polite terms, I might add, that he didn't eat spaghetti with sauce on it. He only ate spaghetti with butter melted on it. "Where do you do that?" I asked. And after a moment's pause, he said, "At my house." "Is this your house?" I asked. And after a slightly longer pause, he said, "No." "All right," I said, "this is our house," referring to his grandmother and me. "And at our house, no one gets a special plate, Patrick. Everybody has the same food on their plate as everyone else because no one at our dinner table is a special person. Furthermore, we thank God for whatever food we have because God has given us this food to eat. We do not tell God that we will not eat something he has provided us." Well, Patrick looked very distressed. But I don't like spaghetti with sauce," he said, a whine creeping into his voice now. "Patrick," I said, "I'm not going to force you to eat, but that is your dinner. You are not getting a special plate. Your plate is going to look like everyone else's at this table." "But I'm hungry," he replied, his whine now verging on a wail. "Then eat what's on your plate," I said. "And Patrick, that's the end of this conversation." At that point, he looked pleadingly at his grandmother for relief, and Willie said, "Patrick, you must do what your grandfather has told you to do. That is the rule in our house." His face began to do the pre-cry scrunch. That's what I call it. And very quickly, I said, "Patrick, we don't allow crying at our dinner table. If you want to cry, you may leave and go upstairs. And when you're done, come back and join us if you want to." His facial expression instantly turned from despair to anger. He picked up his fork, jabbed it into the bolognese, brought up a huge fork fill, defiantly stuffed it into his mouth, chewed, swallowed, then ate another, and then another, until his plate was clean. He then looked at me and said, "Grandpa, that was good." That was the last time Patrick acted like a picky eater at my dinner table. The fact of the matter is, and if you have a picky eater living with you, you may not want to hear this. You may want to change channels at this point. But the fact of the matter is that parents teach children that being picky about food is okay. They teach children that not liking something at first taste is enough of a reason to reject it from that point on. Here's another thing. Being a picky eater is rude. Refusing to eat something someone has prepared for you, even if the someone is your mother, is disrespectful. That person has gone to some effort on your behalf to prepare the food, serve it to you. If you don't have a potentially fatal allergy to a food someone has served you, you simply don't like it, then you should just put your dislike in your back pocket and eat it and make approving noises as you do. Noises like this. Mmm. We always told our kids that we insisted they eat whatever we served them because they were in training to be good guests at other people's homes. It worked. They were eating sushi, the real stuff, as opposed to California rolls by age 10. My point, folks, is that contrary to what the esteemed Duke University psychologist implies, picky eaters are not wired that way, and they are not highly complex, special, ultra-sensitive children who require that parents learn the high art of eggshell walking. Picky eaters are simply taking advantage of an entitlement extended to them by well-intentioned parents who cannot tolerate doing anything that makes their children upset, which is to say, they cannot bring themselves to cause their children to face the reality so eloquently expressed by the inimitable Michael Phillip, also known as Mick Jagger. You can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you just might find you'll get what you need. This is your host, John Roseman. The show is called Because I Said So, a title with multiple layers of meaning. Stay with us. 404-419-6499 is the number. I'll be back in a moment with your calls. All right, welcome back to the show. John Roseman here. Our number is 404-419-6499. 404-419-6499. If you'd like to be on the show, give us a call. Fabi from Atlanta. Welcome to the show, Fabi, and what can I do for you?
Thank you, Mr. John. I have this idea. It's a vision of my two boys making bad decisions or becoming troublemakers in the future because daddy won't play, interact, or, you know, just have quality time with them or even giving them a bath or something like that. I feel like they're going to grow up missing something. It's a fear. My parents didn't do it. His parents didn't do it. He thinks he doesn't have to do it either. Is this a valid fear?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. Let me put it that way for the moment, and let's back up. How old are your two boys?
4 and 2.
Okay, and the problem is that, from your point of view, at least, daddy doesn't play with them. He doesn't do things with them. And this goes as far as he won't give them a bath. And you are feeling, and I would say correctly so, they're missing something here. They're missing a highly involved dad. And your fear, what you originally referred to as your vision, is these two boys growing up to be troubled in some way, shape, or form as a consequence of this. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Okay. So, and your husband, you've obviously talked to him about this, and his response is, my parents didn't play with me. Why do I need to play with my children, correct?
Yes.
Okay, how many times have you talked to him about this? I just want some just general estimate.
We don't talk about it anymore because I already know how he feels, how he thinks. He loves them. I don't have a doubt about that. But his job and you know what he needs to do, he just needs to stay pretty busy.
All right,
that's also a reason. So I don't.
Even when he's at home, he's oftentimes preoccupied with job concerns.
Yes.
Okay. So A, he says my parents didn't play with me. Why do I have to play with my kids? And B, he's a very busy guy who, even when he's at home, is busy concerning his job, whatever it is.
Yes, he does have to do a lot of paperwork on the computer. We all know that the kids say, "Oh, Daddy, where is Daddy? Daddy's at the computer. He's busy working," and they don't seem to care. They respect that I'm the one that is making a big deal.
Okay, all right. Well, that's important. I mean, the boys don't seem to be bothered by this at all. Do you do you feel that the boys know that their father loves them, cares for them?
Yes, a lot.
Okay. And are there times, Fabi, when he does play with them? And are there times when he does pay attention to them? And are there times when he acts like the daddy you want him to be more than he is?
Yes, I expect more. I want, like 1 hour, I want to see him interacting for a long period of time, and so they can feel that, you know, that my daddy is doing this. Like, to me, that in the future, I want them to have a memory that their daddy used to play and do all kinds of things when they were little.
Okay. And what is your fear, Fabi? I mean, specifically, what is it that you imagine to be the outcome of all this, say, 20 years from now when the boys are 22 and 24?
I would like to tell them, or I would like them to come back and say, the reason why I accomplished this is because we had our daddy's support. We had our daddy always there with us and understanding us or playing with us. And I would like them to come back to us and say, we accomplished this because of daddy or because mommy too. Okay. Not just mommy, probably also daddy.
Well, but my question, Fabi, is, you know, he's not as involved as you want him to be. He's not as playful with the boys as you want him to be.
Right.
What is your fear? What do you think is going to be the outcome of this 20 years from now? Do you think your boys are going to be criminals, for example, or do you feel like they're going to be bums, homeless? What is your fear?
All of those things.
Oh, really?
Yes,
okay.
I'm afraid that they're just going to become a lot of things because they didn't have the structure of the male side. Yes, I do have a lot of visions and, you know, like ideas that if they end up like this?
Where did you get these ideas?
I get them from seeing kids right now making bad decisions and the media and the news. And I'm like, did their daddy contribute some to their actions right now? I relate it to their past and their relationship with their dad.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, you're slightly on target here. When you hear news reports of wayward teens, criminal teenagers, juvenile delinquents, overwhelmingly in these kids' lives, there is the absence of a father in the home or a appropriate, I'll use that word, father figure in the home. These kids are generally speaking growing up in fatherless homes, single mothers, in poverty, and so on and so forth. But I think you're extrapolating from that somewhat inappropriately. In the first place, let's talk about your husband's positives. He's a loving father, yes?
Yes.
Okay, and he's a very responsible guy, yes?
Yes.
Right, and he's very hardworking, yes?
Very.
And what about his relationship with you? Do you have a good relationship, the two of you?
A very good one, yes.
Okay, so they're growing up in a home, your boys, where they see a loving relationship between their parents. They see a solid marriage at the core of the family. They see, or are going to see, when they're able to recognize such things, a responsible, hardworking dad who models a very good work ethic and who is a loving father, yes, even though he doesn't spend a whole lot of time with him because he's doing his best to secure the well-being of his family.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. What I just did was I took the elements of your description and I turned them around. You're looking at this from a very negative point of view. He's hardworking. This is my description now. He's very responsible. He's hardworking. He models a good work ethic. He's probably more involved. Yeah. And he's probably more involved with you relationship wise than he is with his boys. And all of that, in my estimation, is very, very good. I mean, there have been some studies which show, for example, that the best predictor of high achievement in school is a solid, good relationship between mom and dad. It isn't, interestingly enough, the highest predictor, the best predictor of high achievement in school is not parents who help with homework. It is not parents who come to all of their children's games. It is a solid marriage between mom and dad, which you have in your home. Now, you're looking at the same things I'm looking at, and you're describing them negatively, and I'm describing them positively.
Yeah, I didn't really pay attention on all of that before.
Yeah, and let me also give a little historical perspective on this. I am 67 years old, and most people my age do not remember their fathers playing with them. And yet our mental health statistically is 10, or was, as children, 10 times better than the mental health of today's kids. And we emancipated earlier than today's kids are emancipating. We emancipated more successfully. We were earning better than today's kids at every stage of adulthood. And so what I'm saying to you, Fabi, is that I think your fears are not well-founded. And may I dare say, I think you've been reading too much. And I think you've been thinking too much. And this is what today's mother does. She reads too much. She thinks too much. And she begins to create what I call psychological boogeymen. And she begins to think the worst. And it's what I call apocalyptic thinking. You're already thinking your boys are going to turn out to be homeless, criminals, axe murderers, you know, whatever, politicians, horrible things like that. And what I'm saying is, I think that there's enough going on in your household of a positive nature that the likelihood is that none of that is going to happen. And so my advice to you is the advice given by the British during World War II, remain calm and carry on. Fabi, thanks for your phone call. I think everything's going to be just fine. I think your husband is doing a good job of being a husband, which is job one. I'm John Roseman. The show is Because I Said So. We are a parenting show. That's what they call it these days. They don't call it raising children anymore. The show exists to try and resurrect traditional, biblically based parenting in America. And I hope I'm succeeding. You can call us at 404-419-6499. We'll be back in a moment right after this break.
American Family Radio Network, it's Because I Said So. Now, once again, here's your host, John Rosemond.
Welcome back. We are at that point in the program where I occasionally, and it'll soon become often, and then it will become regular, and then it will become reliably, do a segment called You've Got to Be Kidding Me. And so here is You've Got to Be Kidding Me. It concerns a newspaper column that I wrote recently in which I addressed a question from a grandmother who was concerned about her two-year-old grandson's habit of biting people when he was upset. Now, the people that he would bite would be, you know, his parents, his mother, maybe his grandmother. And in the course of answering the grandmother, I mentioned something that she already knew, of course, that two generations ago, the standard response to a child who bit was to bite the child back. Now, I mean, you know, I'm not talking about drawing blood. I'm talking about simply taking the child's arm and putting it in your mouth and then applying pressure with your teeth to the point where the child begins to feel some degree of pain and shouts out the fact that he is experiencing pain, which, by the way, is going to occur long before any bruising, or not to mention blood, is going to appear. At that point, you simply back off. So you put the child's arm in your mouth, you apply tooth pressure, the child yells, and you back off, and then you shake your finger and you say no. And believe me, folks, this stops the biting. It may be a paradoxical approach, but it does stop the biting. And you can talk to women who are in their 80s and 90s who will tell you this, that this is what they did when their children bit and it stopped the biting. They might have had to do it two or three times, but that was all. And by the way, the people who were bitten, you know, people in my generation, appear to be healthy, functional, non-criminal types. The fact that they all smile when they're telling the story of how their mothers or grandmothers stopped their biting suggests that they were not emotionally scarred by the experience. Well, shortly after that newspaper column appeared, and my column appears, you know, all over the country, but 200 to 250 newspapers, one of the papers received, the Charlotte Observer, in fact, received a letter of outrage from the executive director of the Cabarrus County Partnership for Children. Now, this is in North Carolina. She contended that biting a child back is considered child abuse by most child protection agencies and encouraged the Charlotte Observer to fire me and find a parenting columnist who was respected, and these were her words, quote, respected by the early childhood education community. Well, she's right. Biting a child back is considered abusive by most child protection agencies, which is nothing more than a prime example of the general dumbing down of the definition of child abuse that has occurred in America over the past couple of generations. Once upon a time, and not so very long ago, child abuse was defined as something that caused a child fairly serious injury, not simply pain. Now, causing pain, for example, a swat on the rear end is enough to justify a visit from the discipline police, the local child protection agency, who zealously proceed to violate constitutional protections against unreasonable search and seizure, as well as the constitutional premise that a person is considered innocent until proven guilty. The problem is not so much the unconstitutional nature of their intrusions, however, but the fact that no one, the public, the people, seem to be raising the least alarm over this. Are people afraid? I ask that if they raise a stink about the manner in which child abuse investigations are conducted, as well as how child abuse is being defined down by child protection agencies, that they will appear to be condoning actual, real, bona fide abuse. Anyway, following this letter to the Charlotte Observer, and I'm not going to mention the person's name. It's irrelevant. A lot of readers weighed in, some in support of me, some not. Several weeks later, a letter from the director of the North Carolina Division of Child Development appeared in the Raleigh News and Observer, another paper that carries my column. And this person, the director of the North Carolina Division of Child Development, said that my advice, mind you now, I've been writing my newspaper column since 1976. It is the most well-distributed parenting column in America by far. This person said that my advice, which I've been giving for over 35 years, was often, quote, bizarre, end quote, bizarre. She went on to say that children bite during the two-year-old stage when many of them have not developed language skills, that's a quote, and that biting them back teaches, quote, if you have power, you can sometimes get away with causing pain. We are to conclude, I take it, that these bitten children, as soon as they gain a bit of power, will begin causing pain to others. This is the standard reasoning in the mental health community about such things. But this is not supported either by anecdote or research. Aggression in children, according to good research findings, is closely associated with, get this, parental permissiveness. Now, I'll say that again. Aggression in children, according to good research findings, is closely associated with, this is the number one predictor of aggression in children, parental permissiveness. I think it is safe to say that people who are permissive do not bite their children back when their children bite someone. In other words, the research clearly indicates that children who frequently cause other children pain are likely to be children whose parents have never caused them any pain, emotional or otherwise. These are people who don't govern their children's behavior very well. As for anecdote, well, the fact of the matter is I've never met someone who told me that after biting her child, the child went on a biting rampage. Quite the contrary, the biting cured the biting. In other words, the biting of the child by the parent or the caretaker cured the biting on the part of the biting child, and the child grew up without further incident. A Raleigh psychiatrist, and I will mention his name is David Colvard, he's a very commonsensical guy, responding to the letter from the Director of Child Development in North Carolina, very impressive title, said that when his now adult children bit as toddlers, he had them bite themselves back. I suppose child protective people, child development professionals would have a problem with this as well. Dr. Colvard said, amazingly, they did not turn into self-mutilators. When Colvard's son first used bad language, furthermore, Dr. Colvard washed his mouth out with soap. And he said, to the best of my medical and psychiatric knowledge, he suffered no harm and still has very clean speech. The contention on the part of the director of child development in North Carolina that biting causes other children to conclude that power and the giving of pain go hand in hand is an example of the modern tendency to substitute rhetoric for reasoned argument. This person cannot prove that what she says is true. All she has is her outrage. To her and others like her, however, the fact that she is outraged is fact that she is correct. Such is the mentality of the zealot who, when in a position of power, is a very dangerous person indeed. By the way, as a result of that column, in response to the grandmother whose two-year-old toddler grandson was biting, I was canceled as keynote speaker for the upcoming North Carolina Association for the Education of Young Children annual conference, which is the sort of price one must pay for telling the truth in these very, very correct times. So we now have on the line Melissa from Northwest Ohio. And Melissa, you've got a question about a 22-year-old, which is intriguing. How can I help you?
Well, my son is the oldest of six children, so he's never had a 22-year-old before. That's my whole excuse, I guess, is that we just don't know other than our own experiences. He is 22, and he has a two-year diesel technology degree, so it's a trade of some sort.
Oh, I'm very familiar with it, yeah. It's a good degree.
He works full-time. Mm-hmm. But still lives at home, and all that he is financially responsible for in our home is his insurance on his car, and that's just pretty much it. He has his own bills, like he's got a student loan that he's paying back. Mm-hmm. He's got his car payment. But other than that, he doesn't have any financial responsibilities. My question is that what age, at what time in his life, in our life, do we start initiating this transition so where that it is pleasant for both of us? If we just say, hey, you need to get out, it's time to grow up, I'm afraid that there's going to be some hard feelings there. At the same time, he's 22, and he only has to pay for his insurance, you know, mm-hmm. So I feel like he's not really learning life if he continues to do this.
I perfectly agree with you. And Melissa, are you willing to hang with us during the break and stay with
sure.
us? And
sure.
All right, then. We're out of time for this segment. This is Because I Said So, a parenting program that approaches the issue of raising children from a traditional biblical point of view. I'm John Rosemond, your host. I'm a psychologist who doesn't believe in psychology. You can find out more about me by going to johnrosemond.com. Our number is 404-419-6499. And if you do stay with us, we'll come right back to the dilemma of Melissa and her 22-year-old son, who's hanging around longer than he should. Be right back. Welcome back to the show. Your host, John Rosemond. Our number is 404-419-6499, and we welcome your calls. We have Melissa on the line. Melissa, thank you for your patience.
No problem.
You are from Northwest Ohio. Where exactly is that?
Well, we're out in the sticks, for one, but we're in between Toledo and Dayton, around the Lima area.
Oh, okay. Sure, I've spoken in Lima before, a couple of times, as a matter of fact, and my column used to appear in the Lima paper. I don't know if it still does or not, but anyway, Melissa,
right.
let's get to the meat of this. You've got a 22-year-old son who is living at home. He's only paying for his insurance. What is that, car insurance, health insurance, what insurance?
Car insurance.
Car insurance. Anything else he's paying for?
No, not to us. He's paying his own student loan and his own car payment.
Okay. Is he paying for his own automobile maintenance, gas, and so on and so
yes.
forth?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yes.
So you guys are not giving him an allowance or anything else like
no,
that?
No, no.
But you are giving him the equivalent of an entitlement anyway. He's living at home. You're not charging him rent. You're not
no.
charging him any room and board.
No, the only other compensation that we might get is because he is in the diesel industry. My husband is an owner operator and has a semi truck, and that he does work on our semi truck, you know, oil changes, things like that. We just buy the
materials.
Stuff, and then
yeah.
he does the work. I mean, that's kind of our excuse for our kickback. Listen, this is our business. If we don't get this done, then you don't live at home for free.
Yeah, and he willingly, if not voluntarily, does this maintenance
always.
On the truck? No.
No, not always.
begrudgingly sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah. Why do I have to do this?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So is his general attitude ungrateful?
When asked to do something on the trucks in our time, then yes, he can be very ungrateful. And then there's the argument back and forth. Well, you know, I have this and this to do, and we're, you know, you live in our house for free. You know, and I hate this argument going back and forth because it just creates strife in the house. But at the same time, he does not pay rent. He doesn't, you know, he is, a lot of his peers his age are out living on their own, and he doesn't know what it is to live and have the responsibilities of an adult. And all we're asking for him is to provide this maintenance on our means of living. And, you know, it's not always, hey, yeah, I'll get right on that. No, it's not.
Right. And so he's not grateful, and his attitude is somewhat disrespectful. And this argument is repetitive. It's occurred many, many times.
Right. Between him, my husband, and him. Yes.
Right. And nothing changes.
No, unfortunately, no.
Okay. Do you have any idea how much he's making?
About $14 an hour.
Well, what does that translate to so that I don't have to do the math?
I don't know. You're talking to the wrong person about math.
Ah, $28,000 a year, my producer has just told me.
Okay.
Off air. $28,000, well, that's pretty good for a 22-year-old.
Right.
I mean, I would say that's, you know, that's more than the average 22-year-old income in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, have you ever said, you know, it's really time for you to move out and we're giving you 4 weeks to find an apartment and figure it out? We love you, but you can't live here forever. And one of these days we're going to have this conversation. And so we've decided we're going to have it today.
Right. We not necessarily in those terms. We have tried to guide him. There is some property that is my mother-in-law's that we said, hey, listen, this is an excellent opportunity for you to buy this. You
okay,
have
wait,
the
wait,
income.
Wait a minute. What you're telling me, Melissa, is that you've made suggestions.
Right,
you
right.
You want him to consider certain things.
Right.
Okay, but everything is cushy at home. Why should he
to
change things?
I know.
Okay, so
I hear you.
Okay, good. You hear me. Good. Because I hope I'm speaking plainly, that until you speak plainly to him,
right,
it is time for you to leave. Your father and I did not raise you to the age of 22 with the idea in mind that you would still be living here in perpetuity.
Right.
We left home when we were around your age. We accepted responsibility for ourselves. We moved out of our
right.
parents' house. They had done their job. We respected the job they did. And we, as you can tell from the fact that you are living the consequences of our decision, we made it. And
right.
so, and you can make it too. And this is no longer a suggestion. Why don't you consider living it, you know, on your grandmother's property, kind of thing? This is a decision we've made. And it doesn't matter to us. I mean, you know, you put it in whatever language you want, but Melissa, you're going to have to be straightforward. You've got to stop beating around the bush and walking on eggshells. And those are very
right.
apt metaphors here. You know, if you want to be heard clearly, you're going to have to speak clearly. And so this is not a suggestion. This is a decision your father and I have made. And if you're not happy with it, well, we're sorry. We're not apologizing for ourselves, but we're sorry that you're unhappy. We would not want you to be unhappy. We would want you to be excited about leaving home and being on your own. We were when we were your age, but
right.
if you're not, that's your problem. It's not our problem. And if you're not happy with this, that's your problem too. And if it causes, I mean, and you don't say this probably, but Melissa, you and your husband have got to understand that the fact that a decision of this sort causes some temporary disruption, and the operative word is temporary, in your relationship with this 22-year-old does not mean that this disruption is permanent. It does not mean that you will never have ever again a good relationship with him, that he will disappear into the world and it will be suddenly like you never raised a child. There'll be no communication. It's not going to be that way. There will be a temporary disruption, and then after a period of, you know, everybody or him going off into his little corner, so to speak, and sulking for a while, he'll come back and say, hey, Mom and Dad, how you doing?
Right.
Yeah. But it sounds to me like you guys are unwilling to make him unhappy. Is he an only child?
Oh, gosh, no. He's the oldest of six.
Oh, okay. Why are you so reluctant to make him unhappy?
Well, because I think our thing is we've never had to deal with this before. He's the oldest. Okay. When it comes to number six, we're not going to have any problems with it because we've kind of gotten used to it. It's just
well, the
new
time to start practicing is now.
Right, right. And, you know, you're not saying anything that I know in my heart that that needs to be done. I guess I just need, a professional to say, this is what you need to do, because that's what I know that we need to do.
Okay, I am the professional. I am John Rosemond, parenting expert par excellence, and I am telling you this is what needs to be done, and that's the way to do it.
Okay.
Is that all you need? That's all people need is just permission from sort of a higher authority, or somebody that they perceive as a higher authority.
I appreciate it because, you are very no-nonsense. You're very, this is what needs to be done. You don't, cushion anything. And our society, we have become so cushioned.
Oh, I know.
We don't want our, and I loved your little excerpt about the biting. That is so true. We've just become so scared to hurt our children in fear that they're going to hate us.
Well, that's true. That is very, very true. Thank you, because, I just feel like, we have become a culture of enablers where children are concerned, and it is to their harm and to our own harm that we do this. Melissa, thanks for being on the show. You were a great caller.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and you're welcome. John Rosemond, and the show is called Because I Said So. Once again, our number, if you'd like to call and be on the show with questions or comments, 40. I was told recently, don't say oh, that's incorrect. So it's 404-419-6499. For more information about me and the show, you can go to johnrosemond.com. And by the way, for those of you who are listening, my name is rather unusual. There aren't that many Rosemonds in America. It's R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D, johnrosemond.com or parentguru.com. I'm a very active public speaker. In the next month or so, I'll be speaking in New Bern, North Carolina. And my speaking calendar is online. You can go to johnrosemond.com again and get that. Mobile, Alabama, Chicago, Illinois, Atlanta, Georgia, Richmond, Virginia, Johns Creek, Georgia, Anaheim, California, and then somebody's got to do it, Hawaii. We are a weekly show at 5 o'clock p.m. Central Time and stations all over America. Again, American Family Radio. My producer, the inimitable Rich Rosel, with assistance from Lisa Wysikowski, who is my managing agent in Buffalo, New York. Our calls were handled by Thomas Rosel, and I'm John Rosemond. You can find out more about me by going to johnrosemond.com, johnrosemond.com, psychologist, syndicated columnist, author, public speaker. And now, radio talk show host, thanks for listening, and be sure to join us again next weekend. Why? Because I said so. From Creative Genius Productions and American Family Radio Network.
minus 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts.
Coming to you from a small undisclosed outpost somewhere in Radioland, it's Because I Said So. Parenting advice with love and leadership from the nation's leading parenting expert, syndicated columnist, author, conference speaker, and the only psychologist to point out that psychology has caused more problems than it has solved for American parents, John Rosemond.
People like this are a menace to decent society.
Call in now about anything from toddlers to teens, even your 20-something toddlers who refuse to stop sucking on the pacifier of your standard of living.
Let's not talk about it in front of the boy.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
From American Family Radio Network, here's your host, John Rosemond.
Hi there, and welcome to Because I Said So, a parenting radio show that approaches the relationship between parents and their children from a biblical point of view. I'm a psychologist, but you won't hear me talking psychology, I guarantee you. I'm John Rosemond, and welcome you to the show. We're going to be taking your calls in a few minutes at 404-419-6499. That's 404-419-6499. But first, I wanted to share a really cool story with you. It's a story about how quickly parents, if they are determined enough, and that certainly is the operative condition, can make significant change in their parenting circumstances. In a very short period of time. And the mother who told me this story last week has given me complete unfettered permission to share it. I've changed the details only slightly to conceal people's actual identities. The family in question consists of two twin boys, age 9, and a 12-year-old girl. Mom, who was telling me the story, called herself a too-big-to-fail mom, and she did it laughing. She said that she had, up until hearing me talk, she came to a seminar of mine that I did in eastern Tennessee at a resort, a wonderful place, and there were about 20 people who signed up for the full 2 days of this thing, and this mom was one of them. And she said that she had, up until that point, just centered her very existence around her kids, thus a too-big-to-fail mom. I love that expression. She was a mom who, and this is, I think, you know, there are many, many mothers in our audience who can relate to the too-big-to-fail mom idea. She was a mom who felt she had to do everything for her children, everything, soup to nuts. She had to solve all their problems, pay attention to them constantly, drive them to as many developmentally enriching after-school activities as she possibly could, et cetera, et cetera. Whatever they wanted or she thought they needed, most of which they did not need at all, she made sure they got. Dad travels a good deal, and early on, Mom began allowing the kids to sleep with her when Dad was gone on the road. Within a short time, as usually happens, the kids were sleeping in the parents' bed when Dad was home. Well, since there were three children, and the bed wasn't big enough for five people, the kids decided to take turns sleeping in Mom and Dad's bed. So two of them would crawl into bed with Mom and Dad, and one would sleep on the sofa in their bedroom. Anyway, Mom and Dad came to this seminar of mine, Eastern Tennessee, 2 days. They didn't feel that they had any particular problems. They didn't see the sleeping arrangement as a problem. They simply came because they thought it might be interesting. And at the end of the first day, they reassessed and decided that, yes, they did have some problems after all. The kids were well-behaved, obedient, didn't throw tantrums, did well in school. But the parents realized there was this serious boundaries issue festering in the family. And I talked a lot about how there needs to be a boundary in the parent-child relationship. And one of the reasons for that is for respect and the children's autonomy. There's a lot of reasons for that. And many of you, and especially those of you who followed my newspaper column for a while or read some of my books, you know that I do not approve of kids being in mom and dad's bed. I mean, occasionally, if the child's running 103-degree fever or something like that, you want to have him close all night so you can monitor him fine. But healthy kids should not be in mom and dad's bed at all. The parent's bed is what I call boundary number one. And if that boundary is not enforced, the parents are going to pay the devil establishing any other boundary. And so mom and dad decided to put an end to it. And in one night, mind you, they did. No transitional period here to help the children adjust or any other such nonsense. One night was all it took. After dinner, and this was the night of day one of my seminar, the kids were there with them participating in the children's program that this resort runs. They sat the kids down and told them, "You're not sleeping in our room or bed anymore. You have your own beds." Actually, I think the parents had driven to the seminar. Their house was close by this resort. They said, "You're not sleeping in our room or bed anymore. You have your own beds. That's where you're sleeping. And don't come into our room tonight, because if you do, we're going to send you back out, or if need be, drag you back out." One of the boys, one of the twins, 8 years old, asked mom and dad, "Are you going to at least leave your door open?" To which mom, this formerly too big to fail mom, said, "Yeah, we'll leave the door open, but if you so much stick a foot across the threshold of our bedroom door, we are going to kick you out rather unceremoniously and lock our door for the rest of the night." And guess what? That night, the kids went to their own beds, which presumably hadn't been slept in for a long time, fell asleep, woke up the next morning in their own beds, and were happy kids. They weren't traumatized. Ain't that great? I mean, it's great for the parents. They have a marriage again. It's great for the kids. They have their own lives back. The kids aren't members of the wedding any longer. The marriage is no longer a fivesome. It's a twosome, as God intended it to be. And if you want proof of that, go to Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. "They shall become one flesh," and "they" is two people, not five. This is a story about what happens when parents decide to put their feet down in unison, when parents get on the same page, take action. Under those circumstances, it does not take long for the action in question to produce the proper reaction. How has this family bed happened in such a short period of time? That's the question. My wife and I, we never slept with our parents. We did not know anyone our age who slept with their parents. We do not know anybody our age who allowed their children to sleep with them. And yet so many of the children of people in our generation are letting their children sleep with them. This happened because of psychologists, once again, attachment parenting propaganda. In this case, the propaganda that comes from people with impressive capital letters after their names say that children are going to bond better, whatever that means, if children sleep with them. So all over the United States, moms who were too big to fail and dads who went along with it usually just began sleeping with their kids. And something that I would have thought as a kid was just the weirdest thing in the whole world has become popular. And that's off the top of my head. I'm John Roseman. This is Because I Said So, a parenting radio show that approaches the relationship between parents and their children from a biblical point of view. We're on American Family Radio Network. My thanks to them for giving me the privilege of doing the show. When we come back, your calls at 404-419-6499. 404-419-6499. Back in a minute.